Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, science writer Michael Brooks returns to the show and talks about his book, At the Edge of Uncertainty, 11 Discoveries Taking Science by Surprise. Michael Brooks is the author of the best-selling non-fiction titles 13 Things That Don't Make Sense and Free Radicals, The Secret Anarchy of Science, both of which we've talked about on previous Little Atoms. He holds a PhD in quantum physics, is a consultant at New Scientist, and writes a weekly column for The New Statesman. And his latest book is At the Edge of Uncertainty, 11 Discoveries Taking Science by Surprise. So, welcome back, Michael, first of all.
Thank you very much.
At the Edge of Uncertainty, that's Jacob Bronowski quote, isn't it? So what do you mean by uncertainty?
So, well, what I mean is the things that, you know, the thing about science is, you know, you can never say it's right. We've been there in the past and we've said, oh, this is how it is, and of course it isn't. And so, you know, those who are kind of canny scientists will never claim 100% that they're right. You know, it's always at the moment, to the best of our understanding, this is where we're at. And that's really what the book is about in some ways. You know, it's about those areas that seem promising, that seem really interesting, but we still can't be sure that they're going to be fruitful fields. I just really like the quote. So the full quote from Bronowski is that knowledge is personal and responsible, an unending adventure at the edge of uncertainty. And I like every aspect of that. I like the fact that our pursuit of knowledge is personal. Mm-hmm. You know, Schrodinger said that science is all about discovering who we are. That's kind of the only thing science really does, is answer that question of who we are. So it's personal. And a lot of these things that we go into, there's a sense of responsibility associated with gathering knowledge about them. So if you're going to sort of research something like chimeras, you know, mixing animals and humans, you've got to be quite responsible about that. You know, you can't just go and do whatever you like doing. And there are people who have tried to in the past, and, you know, and the results have not been good. And so you have this sense of it's personal, it's human, it's responsible, but it is an adventure. It's still kind of, you know, this stuff kind of just lights my eyes up. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at some of these topics and you just think, wow, that blows my mind, that's amazing. And scientists are on this adventure, although, you know, they'll tell you that I over-romanticise science all the time. You know, I remember Jenny Rohn saying to me that, you know, the thing is, you know, you make it out like it's a discovery a day and it's always great fun. And as she says, you know, it's 99% heartbreak working in a lab. But there's still that sense of that's actually why they do it, because it's an adventure. And you're trying to explore something, and you're beyond the edge of what we know. And so it is this, you know, I think human beings have always done these explorations and going beyond, you know, and it used to be geographical, and we kind of ran out of planet to do that on. And now at least we have these scientific frontiers that we try and expand all the time, and we go into that sort of space that we're really unsure about. You know, is it really true that time is an illusion? You know, well, let's explore that and let's sail into those waters and see what we find. And so it's that. I think that adventure and the kind of not knowing whether it's what you're going to find is where it all comes from.
But I don't think people necessarily, the man or woman in the street, is not necessarily aware that science is a quest almost always for the unknown.
Yeah.
People tend to think that we've discovered most things already. Yeah. And indeed, there's been various points in scientific history that are well rehearsed, where people have said, that's it, we've discovered everything there is to know now, and then suddenly quantum theory.
Yeah. There are these classic points in history, aren't they, where somebody says something, and it's almost like they say it, and that's the spur to change. Yeah. And somebody said, you know, we've discovered almost everything there is to know about physics just before Einstein discovered relativity and kind of changed our whole view of the universe. And it's kind of, like you say, it's kind of well rehearsed to say, oh, you know, things always change. change. And these revolutions don't come along all the time. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, you can say scientists have discovered an awful lot, and we do know an awful lot, but there's still an awful lot that we don't know. So I think anybody working, you know, the deeper you delve into a field, the more you realise you don't know about mm-hmm. that particular field, you know, and that's what kind of spurs you on. And of course, you know, in a lifetime, you can only do a small amount of the work that needs doing. So I always think science is this kind of legacy project. You know, you talk about politicians having a legacy. I think scientists have a legacy where, you know, they've done this work, but they've always left far more work mm-hmm. to the next person who comes along.
You also make a distinction, I think, in the introduction to the book, between the donkey work of science is chipping away.
Yeah.
You know, most people, 99% of scientists, are chipping away at the edges of stuff that we already know and making little tiny yeah. sort of steps. But every now and then there is somebody that just makes a massive leap into
yeah.
the unknown.
Yeah, and that, of course, is part of this over-romanticisation of mm-hmm. science, is that actually a lot of lab work is drudge work. Mm-hmm. You're not going to start your PhD and finish it with some, you know, incredible, you know, new grasp of the nature of reality. It's very unlikely that'll happen. It does happen for some people. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, you know, you get people who will just make these discoveries and everybody's wowed by them. But that's, you know, once or twice in a lifetime of maybe 1 in 100 scientists. Now, mm-hmm. some people have used this to argue to say, you know, oh, we've got too many scientists and we should thin it out a bit and we shouldn't sort of put so much effort into dotting the I's and crossing the T's of every subject going. But the trouble with that is you never actually know where the big breakthrough and the big sort of revelation is going to come from. So you have to cover the bases, really.
You mentioned then that there's often somebody comes up with a discovery and there's a wow, but actually, you know, the opposite more often happens in that people tell them to shut up and say, what are you talking about? And you did talk about at the beginning, I want to talk about a few examples before we get into the sort of meat of the book
yeah.
of people in the past that have come to the edge of the cliff, taken the leap, and, you know, either been derided or mocked or thought wrong for decades
yeah.
about things that now we take for granted.
Yeah, so, I mean, and the classic one is the atom, mm-hmm. you know. So we had poor Ludwig Boltzmann, you know, argued for the atom and argued from statistical arguments about pressure and volume and temperature of a gas. And he said, you know, it makes sense that atoms really exist because they would have this effect on the walls of a container mm-hmm. if you change the pressure or change the temperature, whatever. And he made very good arguments. But at the time, nobody wanted to know. You know, so you had people like Ernst Mach, you know, hugely respected physicist working alongside him, who just said, I just refuse to believe that anything other than mathematical constructs, you know. And it seems really bizarre to me because, you know, of course, we've had the concept of the atom since Democritus, since mm-hmm. ancient Greece. So if to our ears, it seems really strange that there might have been this period at the end of the 19th century when people were saying that it didn't, you know, that the atoms actually didn't exist. I mean, Boltzmann wasn't a hugely stable character anyway. It was kind of, I think, what we'd call bipolar now, and ended up, you know, he made one suicide attempt and then he ended up actually making a sadly successful suicide attempt. And, you know, it's all interrelated, I think, with the opprobrium that he got from his colleagues mm-hmm. over this. He once said that he heard Mach, when they're having an argument, just say, I refuse to believe that the atom exists. And he just said it so dismissively. He said it just went round and round in his head. And yet, of course, you know, 5 years after Boltzmann's death, you know, we get Brownian motion. Einstein kind of, you know, shows the photoelectric effect. And we get this whole sort of subatomic world open up. And sadly, you know, Boltzmann died too soon. But it's not an uncommon pattern in physics that you get proved right after you die.
There are a couple of examples that you mentioned where the scientists themselves have been unwilling to believe their own conclusions.
Well. Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because that's kind of classic Popperian science, you know, falsify your own results. You know, you find this thing and then you attempt to sort of find the hole in it. And so you had people like, Henri Poincaré got pretty close to relativity mm-hmm. before Einstein and then realised the whole thing about time dilation and time sort of being, you know, flexible and being able to sort of extend and not being a fixed thing and just walked away from it. You know, it was just like, okay, that's too much for me, and just kind of backed off and didn't want to have to deal with it and sort of left it open for Einstein to do. And then you have people like Benjamin Libet, who discovered that human beings seem not to have free will through his neuroscience experiments, and then literally spent the rest of his life trying to prove himself wrong because he didn't like where it was coming from. And I can understand why he didn't like it. You know, mm-hmm. even today, you know, you can't tell people that they don't have free will. You know, it's a very difficult thing to accept. And no matter what you show them in neuroscience experiments, they always say, yeah, but it's not the same as real life, kind of thing. And that was the best view, that there must be a way that we kind of override this lack of free will, that our brain makes us do something rather than some decision we make. But again, he went to his grave unable to kind of get away from the conclusion.
I'm James Ward. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
You talk about free will, and you begin the book. We'll get into the actual meat of the book now, and you start off looking at consciousness.
Yeah.
And, I mean, consciousness is something that's often described as the hard problem. You sort of elucidate why it's considered impossible for conscious beings to be able to understand consciousness. Why is that?
The trouble with consciousness is that we want all our science to be objective. So you want to get a report of something from somebody else and be able to verify that, listen to it, you know, kind of make sense of it. And of course, consciousness exists inside each person's head. Nobody else has access to that consciousness. And that's why it was kind of said to be, you know, the hard problem is that you kind of never know what somebody else is feeling. You know, you can never be sure that they're an accurate reporter of this, and so it's very difficult to do a kind of scientific experiment on it. But really, I think neuroscientists are kind of getting past that now, and they're saying, you know what, I mean, that's a very defeatist attitude. Why don't we start, for instance, by looking at the circuits that contribute to what we call consciousness? I mean, consciousness is hard. I think it's always going to be hard, but you can start to build circuits and sort of analyse it and break it down and then rebuild things and, you know, look for the signs of something showing the signs of consciousness. And that's not to say we'll get to the end of it and we'll say, ha, right, that's it, that's consciousness solved. I'm not sure you ever solve it, partly because we don't even know how to really define it. But I think it's no longer the hard problem. It's no longer intractable. It's no longer in that class of things that is not really scientific and you shouldn't really attempt. I think it's very clear that we should attempt it, and we've got end-of-life issues to explore, and we've got, you know, the possibility of conscious robots to explore, and there are kind of, you know, moves in the EU to kind of do legislation, put legislation in place, because people are going to have to deal with more and more intelligent robots, and maybe they'll never be fully what we would call conscious, but they'll get close to it, I think. And, you know, there's no reason to think that they won't. So, yeah, so it's not a hard problem.
It's also often been argued that consciousness is something that you either have or you don't have, but it looks like that's not as clear-cut anymore.
No, I mean, and it's funny, because when you look back at that and you think somebody made that argument and that seems to be, you know, you look and you say, oh, yeah, well, that's conscious and that isn't. You know, the rock on the desk isn't conscious. The person sitting in the chair is conscious. And it's sort of like art, you know it when you see it, you know it when you see it. Oh, that's art, that isn't art. And actually what we're seeing is just, it's this complete spectrum of things. And so there's no reason to think that a mouse isn't conscious. And actually, you know, there's no reason to think in some ways that a cockroach isn't conscious. They show certain distinct kind of patterns of behaviour that indicate some kind of consciousness. You know, octopus, it's conscious. You know, there's almost pretty much universal agreement amongst animal researchers now that an octopus is conscious. You know, it's conscious of itself, its surroundings, you know, and you know, everyone would say that their own pet is conscious of them, conscious of being hungry, you know, conscious of things. So there's this whole spectrum of things. You know, it's not on or off, which makes it all the more exciting that as you start to build neural circuit simulations and stuff like that, that, you know, maybe we'll start to see things.
And this is where I want to go next, because if we accept that animals have different levels of consciousness, then that is troubling to this whole idea about human beings being on top of the pie.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. And I think this is going to be our next big battle as a kind of civilization, in a way. I can kind of see it coming. You see it coming. There's a case this week in, I think, going to the New York Court of Appeals about whether a chimp should have human rights. You know, and that's an ongoing case. It's a battle that we need to fight, or we need to look at. We need to examine that, because, I mean, personally, I think it's hard to deny that a chimp should have human rights. I mean,
should a chimp rights?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, why should chimp rights be different from human rights? You know, what you find more and more now is that you talk to animal consciousness researchers and those who kind of look into animal personality and cultures and stuff like that. And it's really hard to see why we feel like we're this pinnacle of creation, why we sort of think human beings are somehow separate and above the rest. And actually, when you look at it, a lot of that comes from, you know, a cultural and religious backgrounds where, you know, we're told in the Bible that, you know, that man is set above the creatures of the earth and given dominion over them and things like that. And that's a very strong cultural belief that we have. And it's very sort of insidious, really, because it has permeated our whole relationship with animals and the animal kingdom. But I say that at the same time as I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm not prepared for scientists to have to give up the right to experiment on animals at the moment. When I was writing that particular chapter, I almost turned vegetarian, but didn't quite manage it. And something in me still is happy to eat meat. But when you look into this, you find a lot of the people who work on some of these issues of understanding, you know, what animals understand and feel and are conscious of, they stopped eating meat. Mm-hmm. You know, they kind of felt like that this was something that they couldn't quite sanction. And so you know, there are issues of, you know, of animal experiments, vegetarianism, animal rights, you know, cruelty to animals, right down to the point where people are questioning whether we should do experiments on a cockroach, you know, because it's not fair on the cockroach. And to most people that sounds absolutely ridiculous, but I think it's a really interesting question to discuss.
I want to look at a couple of examples that you talk about in the book, and you know, for all our consciences, we'll leave the, I don't know, chicken and salmon and what have you alone. Chimps, we're not going to eat a chimp.
Well, not here. So,
not here, but
in Africa, yes.
It's true, but we are in Africa, the Gombe chimps, a group of chimps that have shown, you know, a distinct, culture, I guess. It's not too much of a word for it.
I don't think it's too much. I mean, it's not programmed behaviour. It's not genetic. You know, the same species in a different location does things differently. Mm-hmm. So they eat, for instance, I can't remember which way around it is, but it might be the Gombe chimps or another that you know, will go into a termite nest with a stick, mm-hmm. and then they'll get all the termites on the stick and they'll just put them straight in their mouth. And others will use their fingers to sort of to pull them off. And then eat them with their fingers, you know, and in the same way that, you know, different cultures of humans will eat in completely different ways.
Yeah,
and
yeah. We all have different rules for which fork you use.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. and of course, you know, I lived in West Africa for a couple of years, and it's quite acceptable there to just, you dig in and you eat communally with your fingers. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that going on so much in Hampstead. And, you know, it's kind of, there is a big sort of cultural baggage. And the way they groom, so some groups will groom, you know, and then eat the ticks directly. Some will just flick them away. Some will squash them. You know, that's kind of the way they do it. But you can see these behaviours are transmitted mm-hmm. culturally. There's no kind of other word for it. You know, this is their culture. This is how they do it. And others do things differently.
The other one I wanted to look at was pods of killer whales and the sort of relationship they have with each other as well. So tell us about that.
Well, the interesting thing is, so you get these... I think this is really kind of... It's like there's an obvious parallel here with human cultures, and it's almost unmentionable. So off Vancouver Island, you have these sort of pods of killer whales that sort of live there all the time. And then you have the travelling pods that kind of come in and do things in a different way. So the sort of native killer whales will tend to eat the fish... And they'll speak in a certain, or communicate in a certain dialect. I have to be careful with not anthropomorphizing everything here. They'll have a certain dialect to their tones and their communications, mm-hmm. and they sort of behave in a certain way. And then you get these sort of transient visitors come in, and they'll prefer to eat the seals, so they go, you know, hell for leather at the seal population, and they come in and they have a different, you know, the mode of communication. It's got a different dialect to mm-hmm. it, and you kind of get this kind of sense that, you know, they're coming in on holiday, or it's like a traveller community or something, and they just have different ways of doing things and different, you know, dietary preferences, if you like. So I don't know if it's like Brits going abroad and you know, eating fish and chips when they're in Spain or something, you know. But there's this kind of sense that, you know, you come from one culture, and even if you're in geographically, you know, visiting a certain place, you don't necessarily behave like the killer whales who are there. So mm-hmm. so it seems like obvious that you know, it's unarguable that there are not cultures in animals now.
We've spoken briefly about, and the obvious question seems to be, does this affect how human beings treat animals, if we accept that animals have different levels of consciousness? What does it do to how human beings treat human beings? I mean, how, you know, how does it change how we think about ourselves?
I think it should change, well, for me, it kind of changes that sense that we're special. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, we're nothing special. And we shouldn't act like we are. So that, for instance, should probably change our relationship with animals. But also, I think it enables us to see each other as a bit more biological rather than spiritual or soul-filled beings. And I'm kind of a bit cautious about this because, you know, our particular consciousness and the way evolution has shaped us has made us quite religious and naturally religious. So we've developed, you know, religious kind of ways of thinking, like, you know, we have a soul and that, you know, we have some kind of existence beyond our physical bodies. But that isn't ascribed to the animals in most religions, you know, or certainly not in Christianity. Mm-hmm. It's not that everything has a soul. And I think maybe if there was one takeaway for us, I would say, you know, we don't have souls either. In some ways, this is all we've got is here mm-hmm. and now. And, you know, you should make sure you make the most of life. But that's quite an extrapolation from, you know, looking at animal research. But, yeah, I think that's how it informs my worldview, at least, is that human beings are nothing special in terms of different amongst the animals. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you know, we're special in that we have, you know, a very evolved consciousness, which makes us quite interesting things to be around. And so, you know, I think let's study each other as well. You know, I think, you know, I'm a great observer of humans. I find them fascinating.
Listening to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Michael Brooks, and we're talking about his book At the Edge of Uncertainty, 11 Discoveries Taking Science by Surprise. And in this part of the show, Michael, I think I've sort of loosely grouped the things I want to talk about into things that they're interesting scientific questions, but they're also political questions and societal questions, I think, as well. And as people see as we go along, a few political controversies as well as scientific controversies. You've already mentioned this idea of the chimera, that, you know, the possibility of the use of either animal or human material between the two. Genetic engineering is taking us down that road. When we talk about genetic engineering, those ideas are at the alarmist end of the argument. You know, people think, oh, well, you could make a half-human being, a half-pig or something.
Yeah.
But actually, let's talk about where those things are actually happening. I mean, there are quite alarming things if we allow them to be.
Well, they're only alarming if you see them in a certain way, I would say. You know, for somebody with certain illnesses, they're incredibly promising and hopeful things. So the vast shortage of organs for transplant that we have means that, you know, the prospect of a pig that grows a human liver is an incredible prospect. It's a great prospect. But you always look at it through, you know, whichever lens you come at it from. So people who would say,
that pig's got consciousness.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, if you're the pig, then it's not a good thing, is it? And we've, you know, we've explored this. And of course, fiction explores this a lot with this idea of harvesting organs from other creatures or from other humans. So where we're at the moment is that, you know, I think scientists in Japan have grown a rat with a mouse pancreas, or it might be the way around. I think it is. It's a rat, a mouse with a rat pancreas. And
that doesn't seem like as much of a leap as
human pancreas. No. But I mean, that's the way we kind of think we want to go, because and probably not the pancreas, but, you know, something that would be transplantable eventually, or at least experimentable upon, if that's a word. You know, you can take this mouse with, say, a human pancreas, and you can look at what that pancreas actually does in you know, if you knock out certain genes or whatever, you can see how it changes, and you can find the root of diseases that affect a human pancreas and look for cures. So, you know, these medical advantages of doing something like this are kind of obvious in a sense, although, you know, there is a legitimate question of whether that's Is that a route we want to take? You know, do we want to get to the point where we're saying, you know, it's okay to create anything with something human inside it because it has a medical purpose? And there are those who criticize this medical narrative. You know, scientists often justify whatever they want to do because they'll say, oh, but it's going to help cure the sick or the disabled. You know, we're going to grow new spinal columns for people with, you know, with broken backs. And that you can kind of say, okay, you know, it's hard to argue against it. But then scientists themselves have kind of said, you know, there are some things we don't want to do. For instance, you know, we don't want to put human neurons into a mouse. And we don't want even the prospect of a mouse starting to develop some kind of human consciousness. And equally, putting human genetics into where it can turn into sperm cells, egg cells, inside an animal. So you could have the potential to kind of grow a human embryo inside a mouse is one of the scare stories that the scientists themselves deliberately scared themselves with.
Yeah, that's the one I was particularly thinking about.
I think what's really reassuring is when you look into this field, you know, it's not like the scientists are mad scientists, you know, with crazy hair, running away, doing, you know, anything they can get away with. They're very responsible about this, you know, and this comes back to that issue about science being responsible. They've looked at this and they've said, well, we don't want to go here because we don't know what the outcomes of this might be. The adverse outcomes, you know, the things where you're growing a human fetus inside a mouse's womb, you know, that's not going to happen, we don't think, but we're not sure. So, we're going to stop ourselves from doing that. And so I think there's kind of good news here for those sort of critics of science who would say, oh, you know, the mad scientists, they're doing anything. You know, they're going to kind of destroy the world with their crazy genetic engineering. And actually, there's a lot of very responsible work going on.
Does the place we debate the ethics of that not sort of change the further forward that frontier is? Once we've successfully been able to harvest a liver or a kidney from a pig, is that not at the point where we say, okay, that's done, that's worked, that's normalised, now perhaps we can start putting human embryos into pigs?
I mean, that's always the argument, isn't it, that we won't know where to stop. But people said that about IVF. You know, they said we shouldn't do IVF on humans. And, you know, there's 4 million people alive today who are glad that we did. And so you can always make the argument that, like, oh, but we've got to draw a line in the sand. Because if you cross this point, all hell will break loose. Well, actually, the lesson of history is that all hell has never broken loose with any of this. And so I think, you know, there has to be a modicum of trust. It can't always be a democratic decision. You know, we can't have a referendum on whether we should have three-parent babies, for instance. Because actually, you know, these things are complex. Our natural gut reaction as human beings to alterations of nature is one of disgust, I think. And it tends to be like, oh, you shouldn't do that. Oh, that's not healthy. It's not good. It's not natural, whatever natural means. And so I think you can't always be swayed by that kind of visceral gut reaction that you have. Sometimes you just have to say, well, you debate it both. You look at both sides. And scientists are pretty good at this. And lots of ethicists will work with them on this. And we've looked at both sides. And we think on the balance of things, it's worth doing for, you know, X, Y, Z reasons. And it doesn't ever sanction the next step. That doesn't sanction the next step. When you get to the next step, then you look at that again with the same kind of careful set of arguments.
To what extent, though, do we look at these things like, you know, again, I'll use the example of a pancreas in a pig. It often seems like short term, perhaps. We're going to, after this, the next place we're going to go to is human biology and particularly epigenetics. And we're now discovering that changes in our environment can sort of follow us down the generations. Mm. What danger is there of us making these sort of chimeras and sort of creating new species, I guess, and changing species and putting these changes into these animals for future generations?
Well, I don't think we're yet at the point where there's any danger in terms of, you know, we're not creating things that are just, you know, being set free in the countryside. You know, they're not roaming in our streets or anything, you know, procreating.
Yeah, we want them to bring that liver back.
So I think, you know, this is a very careful advance. It's okay and it's good to question it. I just don't see it as dangerous. That's not a helpful word to use, even, you know, these dangerous scientists. Actually, what for the most part they're trying to do is, you know, they come up against a set of diseases and they want ways to research them. And there's only so far you can go with computer models, although, you know, we're always trying to go further. And I think, you know, sometimes you just need more than just a normal mouse. I mean, you know, of course, we've bred mice and rats very deliberately for experimentation with certain characteristics sometimes, you know, to help us do our research. And this is kind of the next step in that. So the fact that it contains human genetics is, on the face of it, you'd say, oh, no, we're mixing species. But we're not that different genetically from all the other species anyway. So it's not like, you know, we're sort of seeing some, like, mad thing. You know, I think when they analyse the genome, when it's fully done, you know, we're expecting something like 20 of the 20,000 genes to be, you know, exclusively human. So it's not like, you know, we're kind of making some fundamental change. And I think there are good reasons to pursue this research.
So let's talk about epigenetics then. It's always been thought that, like, you know, our destiny was our genes.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What you were born with, that was it. That was sort of the hand you were played. But this is more and more seeming not the case.
Well, it's interesting. So, you know, anybody who's got kids will tell you, you know, they can see from their genetics, they can see, you know, what genetics have been passed on, characteristics have been passed on to their children. And that's kind of, you know, how we started exploring the science a century or so ago. But when we worked out the human genome, decoded it all, you know, we kind of thought that was it. And then you realise that actually it sits in an environment. So within the cells, you know, it's surrounded by various chemicals and it's wrapped up in certain ways. And, you know, so it's not, it doesn't just exist as this kind of, you know, it's not just a long string of DNA that almost like a production line where you just pull things off. You know, it's coiled up tightly and certain environments will change the way it's coiled up. And when that happens, then certain genes are exposed to their immediate environment and chemicals in their environment. And so what we're discovering, I think Steve Jones put it really well. He said, the more we discover about genetics, the more important the environment seems to be. So so we kind of know what the recipe is for making all these proteins using DNA. But what we're finding now is that, you know, not all of them get made. They get made selectively. It's, I think in the book I use the kind of analogy of it being like a menu at a restaurant, you know, and the diners are there picking. You know, the menu doesn't mean everything on the menu is going to be made. You know, the diners are there and they're picking what's going to be made and what's going to be brought to their table. And I think some of what we're discovering in epigenetics is that you know, if you put certain chemicals into the environment of the DNA, then certain results will occur. And I have to say, you know, this is a science that's very much on the edge of uncertainty now. You know, we're starting to unravel some of this, but we don't know how far it goes in humans. We're sort of seeing signs that it travels 3 or 4 generations, possibly. Mm-hmm. So you get these changes that occur because of some chemical in the environment, and then that's passed on down through eggs and sperm. So that sort of marker stays on the sperm where normally it would be removed. You know, and I think there was a study that showed sort of actually 1 in 100 times it's not removed. And, you know, we thought that biology was perfectly efficient. And, of course, this is the whole thing. We're finding the mess of biology, as it were. You know, not only is it not just about the DNA, it's also not about whether the, you know, things get passed on or don't get passed on. It depends on what markers are there. It depends on how efficient the processes for removing them happen to be in that organism. So in plants, you've seen epigenetic changes passed on through sort of 30 generations or something. I mean, humans, we've seen it in 2 or 3 generations, maybe 4. But of course, you know, this is a young science, and actually 4 generations of humans spans the whole of, you know, our genetics understanding in some ways. So you know, it's very early days in trying to make sense of this. But there are some amazing examples.
Let's talk about one of the... There's a number of famous examples.
Yeah.
And I think a couple of them I've talked about on the show before, but a few years ago. So let's do it again. And the one I particularly like is the Dutch during the war.
Example. Yeah. So this idea that, you know, there was this group of Dutch villagers, effectively, who were starved by the Nazis for supporting the resistance fighters. And then it turned out that the women who were pregnant during that time, they produced children who had certain proclivities, I don't know, certain kind of, they were prone to certain diseases. So they were more prone to, I think it's breast cancer, heart disease, and depression, or schizophrenia, I think it was. And that turned out to be also true of their children. So there was something that clearly was passed on down 2 generations. And that's remarkable in itself, because that tells you that if you are affecting a population by their diet, by restricting them, by oppressing them in some ways, and stress is now known to be a cause of epigenetic change and famine as well. So change, you know, stressful changes in diet are also associated with epigenetic changes. And that tells us something about our society. So, you know, when you have, you know, people who are living on the breadline in poverty or whatever, and you sort of say, oh, you know, they just should pick themselves up and get out of it. And actually what you find is that what you've created is this kind of class of people who are more prone to diseases, more prone to, you know, obesity is one of the things that can result from epigenetic changes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it no longer becomes the responsibility of those individuals necessarily, but it's a genetic or epigenetic inheritance they've been given. And so we've got to be very careful about the pollution in people's environments. Actually, you've got to be very careful about the kind of poverty that they live in and stressful situations they live in. And I am kind of making a political point, really, that these things, it's not just, you know, you should pick yourself up out of the gutter. You know, the classic, you know, get on your bike and look for work. Actually, mm-hmm. you know, when you create an underclass, you create a class of people who are, you know, whose health is extremely challenged, potentially, whose, you know, whose ability to kind of get themselves out of situations or ability to, you know, or they'll have an increased mental illness problem. You know, you create all kinds of problems that you weren't necessarily thinking, you know, would cascade down the generations. And then you wonder why it is that, you know, you can't get people out of poverty. Mm-hmm. And we don't yet know that this is all epigenetics, or, you know, we don't know how much of it is epigenetics. But I think it kind of adds fuel to that kind of sense of responsibility that this knowledge brings, that once you realise that you get these kinds of changes going on and they're passed on through generations, then actually I just think it's another argument for kind of dealing with poverty. But, you know, poverty itself is an argument for dealing with poverty as well.
I'm Alex Kratosky, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Well, I want to turn that on its head, really, and next talk about a way in which perhaps we could be said to be responsible ourselves for things that happen to us. So I might be asking you to get on your bike. This seems like an old wives' tale, but you talk in the book about how basically our minds can affect our bodies.
Yeah, it's just such a difficult one because everything in me says, well, A says, yeah, but surely not really. And then there's also a part of me that says, and we've known this for how long? You know, and this is, I think this is where science is catching up and finding techniques for looking into something that we've always known to be the case. So this is the idea, I mean, it's got a scientific discipline to itself now. It's called psychoneuroimmunology. Mm-hmm. But it's the idea that the mind affects the body and that it affects your physical well-being. And the extent to which that is true, we are still trying to kind of elucidate. We're still trying to make find good ways to tell how much difference it makes to be positive, to have a positive mm-hmm. mental attitude. But, you know, this is, you know, you can go back probably millennia and people would say, you know, we've known that being optimistic when you're ill. In fact, I came across a story recently where there's a 16th century astrologer was also a physician, and he was treating the Archbishop of Scotland. And the Archbishop of Scotland treating him for asthma. And the Archbishop asked him to give him his horoscope as well, because, you know, you're an astrologer, you're really good at this, you know, mm-hmm. you've done a good job with the asthma, now just can you do my horoscope? The astrologer said, he looked, you know, he wrote all this down, he looked at his horoscope, it really wasn't good, it looked like things were going to work out mm-hmm. very badly for Archbishop Hamilton. And so he just falsified the horoscope because he said it was more important that the guy was optimistic mm-hmm. to make sure his asthma was, you know, going to stay cleared up. You know, so I love the idea that you've got this.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.